Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Well, Lopate at Large, I'm Leonard Lopate. Some heralded the election of Barack Obama in 2008 as a major advance in race relations in America. Yet, by several measures, blacks, Latinos, and others have gained little ground economically or politically. And the growing presence of white supremacist groups is proof that deep political and racial divisions continue to persist. How deep and how old those divisions are has become a critical question again. Are we still confronting the legacy of slavery? Documentary filmmaker Frances Causey explores that question in her new film, The Long Shadow, which is screening through this coming Thursday, November 1st, at Cinema Village in Manhattan. Frances Causey joins us now to discuss her film and the persistent destructive influence of racism in the United States. Welcome.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
Did you set out to make this film in response to the events of the past 2 years, including the election of Donald Trump?
Well, it certainly contributed to it. But what I was really catalyzed by was Ferguson, the riots in Ferguson, Missouri. And, you know, I had known that things were bad. And then when I began to study the municipal court system there and how racist it was against African Americans, it catalyzed me to really look much, much deeper. And I ended up all the way back at our founding and discovered some very disturbing family connections to slaveholding in the United States.
We'll get to those family connections in a little bit, but I was wondering if you felt whether you were tempted to delay finishing the film, given how rapidly things have unfolded over the past 2 years. We're still seeing some of the things that fit in perfectly with what your film is about.
Sure. And so, you know, we did represent contemporary America in a short way. I mean, there's a lot of history in the film, and it's a good question. And, you know, there were some great films out, Ava DuVernay's 13, and Michelle Alexander was doing great stuff, understanding the impact of Jim Crow. And
then there was the Civil War series on PBS.
Right. I mean, we're a small independent production company, and so I really wanted to tell the story of the Southern political influence, which is kind of a niche, thread in the bigger story of why we are where we are today. And as a small independent company, it's difficult for us to react, to go out in the field and cover, what's happening immediately. But even moreover, Leonard, we really wanted to show that this problem we're having is deeply, deeply embedded in our DNA, and it goes all the way back to our founding, which casts a lot of questions about the myths surrounding our founding, but more importantly, how the terrible institutional racism and overt racism of the South and their politics spread to the rest of the country. I mean, you know, the film is really a backstop for people to understand the context for everything anti-racism anti-black racism, what happened, just, you know, the terrible events of Pittsburgh. The film really explains the creation, the artificial construct of whiteness, you know, by our founding elites and how that impacted us today. We connect the dots to today, as you say.
Berkeley law professor John Powell says in your film that we're still fighting the Civil War and the South is winning.
Yes. Yes, I think what we're seeing now, some of your listeners might be familiar with the Southern strategy, which was a strategy by geopolitical, the GOP in the 70s.
Richard Nixon and his administration.
Yes, well, I was getting to that, right? And so that used to be a dog whistle, right? There used to be this kind of pandering silently to, you know, to what I think is probably 20, 5, 30% of the country that's pretty hardcore racist against others, as John points out in the film. But we, you know, we really wanted to show that, that this was not what's happening now. The Southern strategy is being instituted all over the country and by the GOP, and they're, you know, they're not even bothering, as you so well point out in your intro, you know, they're not even bothering to cover up these dog whistles. They're just overtly pandering to this element of our society. And, you know, the country is struggling to try to understand what's happening. And we believe that, that our film really lays it out.
You mentioned your own family history. Your family has roots in Virginia dating back to before the Revolutionary War. Now, Virginia enacted its first law acknowledging slavery in 1661, one of the first states to do that. Where was your family at that time?
Well, the ancestor I talk so much about in the film, Edmund Pendleton, isn't born at that point, but he was a third generation colonist at that point, right? America wasn't America yet. But what we talk about in the film, almost from the get-go, really at our founding, black and white were way more equal than they are today, which is just amazing, as Mr. Powell points out, you know, in terms of intermarrying and things like that. There was a lot more integration in the early 1600s than almost there is today. But what happens is indentured servants, both black and white, once the founding fathers realized that they could scapegoat blacks at the expense of poor whites, which is also happening today by elites, you know, they begin to create whiteness, right? And so no matter how poor you are in the 1600s in the United States or in America, you are better than a slave. And so we see this artificial separation between black and white, honestly, is really about economics. I mean, they needed the slaves to clear, you know, I can't drive through Virginia or North Carolina without looking at a cleared field and wondering, you know, how many slaves suffered to clear that field of trees. And so what we do throughout the film is that we show this white imposition of power in large part, certainly before and then later after the Civil War, at the behest of you know, at the power being driven by the South and their ideas of racial superiority.
Well, actually, the Europeans also liked the idea of whites being superior as a justification for colonialism.
Sure, absolutely. But what you see later on, right, what you see is in 1772, Britain outlaws or begins the process to outlaw, in a case called Somerset, begins to outlaw slavery. Because actually, and there's some incredible scholarship by a historian named Gerald Horn, and he really looks at the geopolitical temperature of the day. And in fact, Britain was a lot more interested in imperial ambitions. It's the height of the British Navy, and they actually wanted American slaves or colonial American slaves to go fight for them in other places. And so, you know, Britain is kind of with that pesky colony, but it's very controversial on our own shores, obviously. And so, people like my uncle, who are slave owners, they've been importing huge numbers of slaves, and they're very afraid by the time the revolution comes around. And my uncle was a leader. He was the first effective governor of Virginia from 1774 to 1776 during the revolution. They're very fearful that if they don't win or if they don't declare war on Great Britain, slavery will be outlawed in what would become the United States, because it was already moving that way towards that outcome in Britain. And now, of course, Britain was doing a lot of stuff in the Caribbean. I mean, they certainly were making huge profits off of slavery. I mean, this is one of the things I think is so fascinating about the scholarship that we use in the film from so many important scholars on the subject. The true hidden cost of slavery, or it's just been hidden, it's been buried. And what we do is We tell some familiar history, but we connect the dots to a different history, which really shows the concerted effort and the impact of the slave trade on our country. And I argue in the film that this directly connects to some of the issues that we're facing today, particularly when it comes to economics and access by African Americans to the American dream.
Getting back to that court decision from 1772, Somerset versus Stuart, it held that slavery was not supported by common law in England and Wales. So did colonial leaders fear that the government in London might try to end slavery in the colonies? Because they weren't going to end it in the Caribbean.
Well, now there you have you're connecting the dots directly to my family. So what happens, right? So Edmund Pendleton he's kind of older. He's Thomas Jefferson's lawyer. He's an elder statesman in terms of the revolutionaries. He was much younger, and he basically, again, it was controversial, and they knew that they didn't want to deal with slavery in the Declaration of Independence or what was becoming this document, right? So Edmund Pendleton, along with George Mason and others, of course, helped draft the Virginia Declaration of Rights in the 1775, leading up into the spring of 1776, I believe, are the dates. And they ask him to come up with, this is fascinating, Leonard, they ask him to come up with a dog whistle line, mm-hmm. right? Because if you're going to exclude slaves, because if you're going to break from Britain, you have got to have slaves, and you've got to have the North, you've got to have the South, you know, and what Virginia did, all the other colonies did, for the most part, it was the wealthiest and biggest colony, right? So Edmund Pendleton comes up with this line to be added to the Virginia Declaration of Rights to deal with this thorny issue of what do we do with the slaves because of all these great ideals of freedom and liberty and stuff. I mean, we hear Lexington and Concord and the Tea Party, but we rarely hear that Edmund Pendleton drafted a line when they enter into a state of civil society. And so the buzz around Philadelphia, going from, Virginia up to Philadelphia, was that, don't worry, everybody, we're going to maintain slavery, because by then it was the backbone. I mean, there's just no question. It was the backbone of the American colony, the economy there. And so he writes this line, and everybody's like, okay, the leadership of the future United States of America is convinced, or, will continue slavery. And so, I mean, obviously still continue to be controversial, but it was this first dog whistle that he wrote. And then the rest is history.
Well, recently we did a show on Dr. Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the mm-hmm. Declaration of sure. Independence, but he seemed to be pretty much a lone voice as an abolitionist, and he right. lobbied the city of Philadelphia to abolish slavery, and Philadelphia right. Turned him down, even though he was one of the heroes of Philadelphia. So is there also a shadow of slavery's history in the North, a shadow over the North?
Oh, it's more, Leonard, than a shadow. And it's very easy to kind of put it with the South because of the continuing bad behavior where I grew up. But oh, absolutely. I mean, so Wall Street, of course, there's some very famous examples. Wall Street is driven by slave profits. I mean, even there's some wonderful scholarship on this. They're mortgaging slaves. They're doing credit default swaps, basically, regarding slaves. You have insurance companies that are built up. I mean, this is a thing that was so offended me as a kid, which is why I had to make this movie, is that we didn't hear the true story in our textbooks about the impact of slavery. And so it is such a well-defined part of the economy that by 1830, Leonard, the value of slaves far outweighed all other combined commerce in the United States. It was the most profitable institution. I mean, by the time it gets to New Orleans, You know, and of course the country went to civil war over the spread, you know, to save the Union, but also over the spread of slavery west. And so there actually, there's wild speculation, not unlike today with Bitcoin or, you know, real estate. I mean, there's wild speculation over slaves in New Orleans.
You mentioned,
so we went there.
Oh, finish, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's cool. So, yeah, so what people don't understand is that they were afraid. There were so many slaves in the United States. They were afraid of slave revolt. And they, you know, they were, you know, brutalized generation after generation after generation until finally it comes to a boil in the Civil War.
You mentioned insurance companies. Aetna profited from slavery.
Sure.
AIG, Barclays, parts of what's now J.P. Morgan Chase profited from it. How much of the inequality that's growing now rests upon a foundation of slavery?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. You've done your homework. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, this really, really is the, I think, the cornerstone of the film, if you will. It's that how the American dream, the economics of the American dream, really were predicated on slavery. And then later, even up in the 30s and 40s, and even today with housing, access to the institutional access to African Americans has been severely compromised. And I'll give you probably my most favorite example is, so the Civil War ends, Reconstruction, you know, the North leaves the South, Reconstruction comes in, and the South reasserts. I mean, the South never really took it on the chin politically, right? And so the South reasserts itself. I mean, you have more Confederate monuments built from 1900 to 1940 than at any other time in our history, as well as lynchings. You have more lynchings than at any other time. So the South and the Dixiecrats have reasserted their power. And of course, in the 30s, the late 30s, the country is collapsing. And FDR, at this point, the South is so unified and so politically powerful that the South goes to FDR, who's crafting his New Deal, which includes Social Security compensation, right, for older people, and other, obviously other, other benefits for society. And the South goes to FDR and says, we will not pass, we will not vote for the New Deal if you include the two prime African-American vocations of the era, which is sharecropping and domestic service. So two of the most important things, you know, cornerstones or foundations of the American dream, Social Security and housing ownership. So you see, this is what I learned in a great book called The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein, is in the film. He talks about housing policy. We resegregated housing after World War II. You have World War II veterans, black World War II veterans coming back, Leonard, that are decorated war heroes. They can't buy into Levittown, you know, just east of you in Long Island. They can't buy in. And by the time the civil rights movement effectively outlaws discrimination and pushes for the 1968 Fair Housing Act, that wealth, that equity that my family, perhaps yours or other families, grew with housing ownership, was the train had left the station for African Americans.
It took a long time for African Americans to be able to buy into Levittown.
Say again, Leonard?
It was many, many years later when African Americans were finally able to buy a house in Levittown and some of the other places, because it was the equivalent of redlining. But first, let me tell my audience that I'm speaking with Francis Causey, whose film, The Long Shadow, is currently screening at the Cinema Village in Manhattan, but only until the 1st, and then maybe later you can tell us where people will be able to see it after that.
It's playing all over the country right now, so I'd love to let your listeners know where they can catch it.
Now, you were talking about FDR. He relied on the Southern Democrats. At that time, the Democratic Party, a large part of it, was very much the party of segregation. So things have changed since that time, but only, I guess, interestingly, a Southerner, Lyndon Johnson, probably was a key factor in turning things on their head.
Right. I mean, he had the courage to say, you know, with the Civil Rights Act. I mean, as Dr. Allen says, of William and Mary says, you know, it was clear that the South was not going to, I mean, the discrimination had become still, it was still the, a large part of the culture of the North, but it was outlawed. Some of, you know, Jim Crow, some of these terrible laws, local laws were, and state laws, you know, were in the North, but it was, of course, going strong, and Johnson knew and had the courage to know that there was going to have to be some federal intervention. And so what you begin to see is pushback immediately almost all across the country. I mean, remember, you know, the reaction in Boston to the desegregation, right? And so then you have also what I would argue today's artifacts of the story that I tell are, you know, obviously mass incarceration, you know, rampant inequality, disproportionate police brutality against predominantly, you know, black males, you know, black females, you know, black school children being disciplined at much, much higher rates. And it's like, until we study this, you know, and come to grips with Jim Crow and slavery, we're not going to get anywhere, and we need to study it, and it will also shine light on these other issues that we're having against anyone who's a non-white, you know, is not a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. I mean, quite frankly.
Getting back to Wall Street, wasn't the Wall of Wall Street built in part by slave labor, and wasn't the Wall Street area once the site of slave auctions?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Isn't there?
Built over. I think it's paved over where the first slave wall, you know, first wall built by slaves was. We went to New Orleans and, you know, we were down there and, you know, it was really busy. And I was looking for this one-time slave exchange. And I looked up and, you know, they had the decency to not take off the exchange part. But there wasn't a marker or anywhere. It's some hotel down in New Orleans now. And it's like there's no marker to it. There's no acknowledgement of the terror and just, you know, terrible things that took place there. So, what I love about the movie is it's got so much in one sitting. I mean, literally in 80 minutes, you can pretty much get up to speed. And I'm very, very excited that the African-American community has embraced the film. They love it and are showing it wherever they can.
Now, you mentioned going to New Orleans. If you go to the South, you go to Atlanta, places like that, you expect to see segregation in housing, but pretty much every major northern city is very segregated. New York is, Chicago is, Los Angeles is,
right.
Boston is. So that's despite the fact that they were not slave, those cities are not in former slave states. Isn't there a growing body of research that argues that slavery was central to how capitalism evolved in the United States?
Oh, no question. And it is. I mean, there's just no question. So let's look at that specifically, right? Housing, right? Corner, you know, important aspect of the American dream. So you look at the role, for instance, and there are whites who have Section 8 housing vouchers as well. Don't get me wrong. There are poor whites who struggle, but nobody institutionalized racism, anti-black racism, the way we did. So for the matter of the discussion, we'll talk about that. So even if you're a developer, right, a commercial real estate developer, and you want to try to put, for instance, Section 8 housing in places where the schools are good, right, because as we know, the quality of our schools is tied to property taxes in most areas, right? And so what happens is you see the legal discrimination get outlawed in housing, but you have in housing and in other areas, Leonard, you have in what I call implicit bias, right? So developers, even if you have a developer who wants to put Section 8 housing in a nice neighborhood, there's usually such a backlash, And this describes Ferguson to a T, really. You have such a backlash against putting public housing in those areas that the developers get in and move off. Or, as the Obama administration tries to do, you try to enforce, you know, fairness at a federal level, and it's just so difficult. There's so much implied bias, you know, with a significant number in our population that you just see the cycle repeating itself over and over and over again. And so you do have a lack of integrative housing.
What did you witness of the long shadow of slavery when you were a child in the South?
Sure. Well,
would it be all that different today?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think to some degree, not in terms of institutional things like with housing. I don't think we've made much advance there. I think, you know, I witnessed things like, you know, the lady, you know, as most children of privilege. I mean, we had African Americans working for us, you know, Southern children of privilege. And, you know, the maid who was just this wonderful woman who was just, she was wicked smart and just the kindest, one of the kindest people I've ever known. You know, she struggled to take phone messages. She had had to leave school in the fourth or fifth grade, you know, to come to work to earn money for her family. Or there was a lady who cooked for us, and I was about 14, I think, and my parents were going out of town, and I was so excited because Gwen was going to come babysit for me, and I had a twin bed, and I thought, great, well, it'd be like a big slumber party. And she arrived, and she didn't come back to my room. I was going to help her get settled, and you know, and after a few minutes, I went in the kitchen where she cooked for us, and she was making it was a hard floor. It was a hardwood floor. She had pitched some blankets and made a little pallet for herself, and she was going to sleep there. I had seen a lot of things, and witnessed just probably the grinding poverty so upset me.
So she just assumed that's what she would have to do.
I'm sorry, say again?
She just assumed that that's what was expected of her.
It was incomprehensible to her that she would sleep alongside me, that lest my parents find out, or, you know, she passed away before I had a chance to ask her, but it crushed me. It crushed me. You know, it was like the wheels came off after that, and I later went on to become a journalist and empower myself to kind of, you know, tell these stories.
This is Leonard Lopate at Large. Let's talk about some other things that you deal with in the film. The Constitution, which was ratified in 1788, included the Three-Fifths Compromise, something we learn about in high school, but I'm assuming most people kind of forget. What did the compromise do, and how did it affect the balance of power in this country?
Well, that and the Electoral College, Leonard, I mean, these things were all built around maintaining slavery, right? So, again, I alluded to this earlier, right? So the South had so many slaves. And eventually, when the Constitution was being written, it was like the North said, okay, you know, in an appeasement, I guess, to the South, they said, okay, slaves can't vote, of course, but we'll count when it comes to determining how many seats, you know, you're represented in Congress. We'll, you know, the South pushed for and got that every slave in the South or anywhere would be counted as 3/5 of a voter, right? And so this gave, you can imagine, right, if there are hundreds of thousands of more people in the South because of slavery, this gave the South, and this is really important, this gave the South disproportionate political power leading up to the Civil War, and I would argue after as well. 5 out of the first 7 U.S. presidents were from the South. The Electoral College was also designed to maintain slavery. The Second Amendment was also designed to maintain slavery, which is also relevant today, right? Well, they needed guns to keep the slaves from revolting.
So the Electoral College, which has played such an important role in some recent elections, was devised simply as a way of giving the South more power?
In essence, I didn't put a lot of the Electoral College in the film because we wanted to show so much of this white gerrymandering, but we also wanted to show in the film incredible examples of you know, African perseverance. So I don't specifically know. I have read scholars who've researched about the history of the Electoral College. And it's common sense.
What percentage of the founders of the signers of the Declaration of Independence or the framers of the Constitution owned slaves? Do we know?
I don't specifically know. Obviously, all the ones from the South pretty much owned slaves, and I would venture to guess a majority.
And I would assume that some of the signers from the North also had slaves.
Without question.
Francis Causey, the director of a film called The Long Shadow, which is currently at the Cinema Village in Manhattan, running only until this Thursday, although this looks like the kind of thing that PBS would or HBO would love to broadcast sometime in the future, and I hope that they do.
Please.
From my lips, out there, right?
From your lips to God's ears. I mean, we really struggled getting the film in Southern film festivals and in Southern theaters, although I'm going to be in Chapel Hill November 12th for a screening at my alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill. The film doesn't pull any punches, and I think some people are afraid of the reaction, but I can tell you that we rarely have anyone get up for the entire time. I mean, the film is riveting, and folks can go to thelongshadowfilm.com. They can see the trailer. They can scroll down. They could pre-order a DVD, a digital download, and also see the current nationwide screenings. Last night we were in Fort Collins, Colorado. As you mentioned, we're at Cinema Village on East 12th Street up until Thursday. We will eventually, get the film. We did get rejected by PBS already, and we're going to try to go back to them and see if we can, if they'll reconsider. We're going to, as I said, Chapel Hill. The film is going to be tonight in Oakland at the New Parkway. We've got San Francisco dates, and we're adding theaters every day. So you can find out more at thelongshadowfilm.com.
Haiti's revolution against France broke out in 1791 and ran until 1804, making Haiti the second independent country in the Americas. Wasn't it really a revolution of enslaved Africans?
Oh, without question, Leonard. And it is a seminal event in world history, absolute seminal event, because it was the first black-led republic, on this side of the world. And so what's fascinating, and Gerald Horn talks about this in his work, what happens is, this is something that people don't know or don't realize, is that there's so much slave revolt in the U.S. that's never been reported. Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, some of the more familiar ones. But so American slave owners are terrified during the Haitian Revolution that the white slave owners, I mean, if they weren't killed, they were going to bring their slaves with them, try to get them out of Haiti and go to the United States, which would have, again, this idea that there were so many more slaves in the U.S. than white people. I mean, there was this constant fear of slave revolt. And so, I mean, the Haitian Revolution has far-reaching impacts really all over the world. There have been several great books written about it.
So how did the American founders react to this revolution in Haiti?
They were terrified.
They didn't hail the defeat of European colonialism in the New World, something that was similar to what we had done.
Right, right. No, they mainly were, you know, just again. So again, you see indigo and rice and tobacco and all these crops, cotton. Boy, that's another story. Cotton. You know that they really can't afford any kind of intrusions into their business. It's like anything else. It's like if you're a farmer, you don't want, you know, you don't want bad weather, too much bad weather, because it's going to ruin your wheat crop. I mean, this is the kind of callous, unscrupulous, you know, terrible way that they think about these human beings as property, as chattel. They, you know, they looked at it in the Haitian revolutions very much in terms of, well, not only having their own throat slit in the middle of the night, but they think in terms of, how is this going to impact my business?
And the U.S. didn't recognize Haitian independence until 1862, 58 years after the revolution.
Right. Now, so that answers your question right there.
On the other hand, there was an abolitionist movement that was picking up steam in the United States. How did politicians from slave-owning regions respond to criticisms of slavery? Did they attempt to gag the debate?
Absolutely. I mean, everything they could. And of course, but there's this prevailing feeling that slavery is so, so wrong. And the abolitionists go a long way towards, you know, going towards pressure to bring about the Civil War. There's just no question the abolitionists. But what happens is, like, after most wars, you begin to see a downturn in the economy after the Civil War. And so the North leaves the South after about 10 years. And, of course, that's when we see things like the Black Codes and convict leasing and the beginnings of Jim Crow popping up in the United States, and it's in the southern United States, and it's just particularly egregious, the suffering that's done, for instance, with convict leasing. I mean, before the revolution, you have slaves that have a material value in terms of, but with convict leasing, excuse me.
Convict leasing is a form of slavery, you're saying.
Right. And so, you know, convicts in the South, people are rounded up. Excuse me, I don't have any water with me. Bad choice. Convicts are used up, you know, spit out, and they're more, you know, they're more convicts to replace them, because their local sheriffs have deals with local mining companies in Alabama, for instance. And they're just creating this constant flow of convicts. They're picking black folks up for, like, getting on the sidewalk and, you know, anything they can to get bodies that they can actually sell them again to corporations. So, and then they go and they die in the mines, and they're treated just terribly, even worse, perhaps it's sometimes even worse than they were in when they were enslaved. And, you know, there's a great book called, or I think it's a documentary called Slavery by Another Name, about convict leasing.
Now, getting back to before the Civil War, did any slave owners express reservations about slavery? There was a slave owner named Robert Carter who decided to free his slaves. How was that received by other slave owners?
Well, this is another part of the fascinating hidden history about slavery. Thomas Jefferson had expressed reservations about, he was a slave owner, but he had expressed reservations about slavery.
But he didn't free his slaves.
Of course not. He was making too much money. It was the foundation of his wealth. But there was a gentleman named Robert Carter who was the third, who was the richest slave owner in Virginia. And I believe he started out as a Baptist, and he worshipped alongside his slaves. And, of course, later from the pulpit, once they realized how profitable slavery would be, that ended, and blacks and whites no longer worshipped together. But Robert Carter truly had a religious conversion. He said, this is wrong, and he had 492 slaves. And he frees them all over a period of years, much to the consternation of his family and other slave owners, right? I mean, but he did it. He did it. And one of the more beautiful parts of the film is we interviewed the descendants, LaTanya Lawson Jones and Tom Duckenfield. We interview them, their ancestors of the slaves who were freed by Robert Carter. They've started the Nomini Hall Slave Legacy Project. The Nomini Hall was a plantation where their ancestors were buried. But what they point out, too, I mean, it shows the perseverance and how slaves fought back. And despite being, you know, the possibility of being re-enslaved.
What opportunities did they have when they were freed slaves? What could they do? Did most of them just go north or try to go to Canada?
No, they didn't really have the resources to do that. I mean, you know, as they point out, as Tom and LaTanya point out in the film, they could own a little bit of land. I mean, they could have implements. One was a weaver. I mean, they were farmers. I mean, they eked out. I mean, they were very entrepreneurial. They were very intrepid, despite this threat of re-enslavement, you know, just by a white person's affidavit. Even if they weren't owned by a white person who said, that's my slave, he ran away, she ran away, they could still be, that's all it took to re-enslave them. And so, as Tom points out in the film, they as free peoples, they were able to navigate this system, and they were able to pass that on to their next generation. And so there's just a tremendous amount of pride in their families about their history. And they have that history to hold on to. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, is so difficult, I think, for a lot of African Americans. They don't have records. I mean, the only records that exist are really beginning in 1860 with census, you know, figures about, you know, ex-slave owner owned these slaves. And it's just their name. One name and their age, and their, you know, young girl or, you know, male, you know, 30-year-old male. I mean, and so there've been, you know, terrible, there must be terrible repercussions not knowing your family history. I found all this history out because, you know, my ancestor was a slave owner and as many generations were on both sides of my family, and there's copious. There was a Pulitzer Prize-winning book written about Edmund Pendleton, incidentally by an author who was associated with or led one of the most notorious lynchings, a guy named Edward May, one of the most notorious lynchings in Virginia. And he actually wrote this history. Because Pendleton was seen as a conservative, and so he's kind of a folk hero today among very, very conservative, folks, because he eventually came around to see that we should break from Great Britain, but he was very reluctant to do that.
It was assumed that technological innovations like Eli Whitney's cotton gin would actually ease some of the pain of the slaves, but didn't it have the opposite effect?
Yeah, that's a complete misnomer. No, what it did is it made cotton. I mean, cotton became the most profitable commodity the world had ever known to that point, right? And so, if you could do it faster, I mean, you still had to pick it, right? And it just takes off. I mean, the cotton production just takes off, and when Whitney creates this machine and that's when it really kicks into overdrive, the frenzy for the cotton, and the prices.
Now in 2018, some economists are arguing that stagnant pay and work conditions are hindering productivity. What did slave owners do to keep their slaves productive?
Well, you know, sadly, tragically, they bred more and more slaves, as I say in the film. There's one particular, I think Charles City is the name of it, in Virginia. They bred more slaves. Again, eventually, it's still so controversial. We ban the importation of slaves. But that, so what that does is we, I forget the year that we did that, but a lot of people are confused about those kind of dates. I mean, but we didn't ban slavery within our own country. We banned the importation, the Atlantic slave trade. You couldn't bring, and a part of that was protecting the slave owners, protecting their monopoly. So what do? They breed more and more slaves on their own shores.
The Supreme Court is always a controversial place, but some of the decisions that the Supreme Court came up with really reinforced slavery and then later discrimination. You have the Dred Scott decision in 1857,
right.
And then later you have Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, right. That institutionalizes separate but equal. Now, for a short time after the Civil War, there were actually freed slaves who were elected to office. What happened? How did we get from that to Plessy versus Ferguson?
Right. So what you have, I think, and I'll leave some of the particular details to Supreme Court scholars, but what you have, I mean, constitutionally, in those two cases, I mean, in Dred Scott, these are the few little tidbits we got, you know, growing up, and even now these things are being whitewashed from the pages thanks to the textbook, you know, the Texas School Book Commission, you know, approves a lot of the textbooks. I mean, slavery is being reinvented as a states' right issue, right? And so
a noble cause.
Say again?
A noble cause in some circles.
Right. Right. So you begin to see what happens terribly at the local level is you begin to see these local laws, these state laws. I mean, you've got it at, you know, court, more contemporary, they begin to outlaw with the Civil Rights Act. But you have these local laws and these customs. And again, the importance of this implied or implicit bias that is passed, Leonard, from generation to generation to generation. And so then fast forward to today, and, you know, the ultra-right, you know, these nationalists, these white nationalists have been very effective at saying, you know, well, maybe not so much, you know, the people that unfortunately, you know, Sayoc and the ones who did, you know, the guy who did Pittsburgh, the massacre in Pittsburgh, yeah. But you have politicians cleverly backing up that narrative of that dialogue with, oh, well, you can't infuse race into, and there's an important Supreme Court case in the 1950s that said you can't inject race into politics or law. Well, that's absurd. I mean, we've never dealt with the impact of how we did, you know, racially infuse our laws and our Constitution. And so we haven't even studied it, and we're already saying that it's, you know, that we can't do anything based on race. Now, of course, there's affirmative action, which needs to continue to take place to right these old wrongs. But, you know, unless we recognize that there's a problem, or that this history, I mean, we did it with the Japanese in the 40s. We interned them. We dealt with it. We gave them, you know, remuneration. It's like we've yet to do anything like this collectively as a nation with regards to slavery. And I contend because we're still so racist as a country.
Well, weren't the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments of the Constitution, the Civil War Amendments, intended to address the injustices of slavery?
They did. So what they did is they outlawed slavery as a business per se. But you could, if someone was convicted of a crime, and Ava DuVernay talks about this so beautifully in 13, if you were convicted of a crime, that would be, you know, that would be null and void. I mean, you really could be enslaved, and that's when convict leasing came up. So yes, we ostensibly, you know, outlawed these things, but they continued to live on in white culture to great benefit. You know, I mean, the Dixiecrats, this extends even to like national health care. I mean, there was, I think it was Eisenhower that was trying to get national health care in the 50s. And the South said, nope, we're not about to be in the same hospital with African Americans. I mean, we can't even, in 1938, we can't even outlaw slavery. We can't even agree as a country to outlaw lynching in the 1930s.
Now, Michelle Alexander,
this has just been a regular, you know, this has just been a very blip in time between then and now.
Michelle Alexander and others have argued that we're seeing a new Jim Crow in the form of laws that disproportionately penalize blacks. And also, we have been hearing reports of voter suppression, redistricting, the kind of moves that are being made by people like Brian Kemp in Georgia.
Right. So what I contend, just like the white slave owners in the 1600s scapegoated people of African descent, so the poor whites would vote with them and would be allied with them, the same thing is taking place today. This, again, this dog whistle, this racist dog whistle. Well, blacks are getting all the welfare and, you know, and white, poor whites are saying, well, I want welfare, but blacks are getting welfare at the expense of me. I mean, this is just, and Ian Haney Lopez in the film talks about this, and there's this larger picture of scapegoating, you know, pandering to these emotional kind of base arguments that when people's livelihoods or their existence is threatened. This has been going on in our country since its founding. And a lot of people know this, and we just finally, you know, we just examined it, we investigated it, and really connected the dots of this history to the present.
You tell
so
the
again,
story.
I mean, it's hard to sometimes quantify, Leonard, you know, these thoughts, feelings, and how this discrimination takes place, but there's no question it's there.
Well, some of the shocking stories you tell, like the one of Thomas Willis, who was shot along with five of his coworkers by another worker, Douglas Williams, at a Lockheed Martin plant in 2003. Five of the six people Williams killed were black, and a Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans ruled that the killings were accidental. So do cases like that illustrate the effects of the long shadow?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned it, because that's a tangible, material example of how far we have to go, right? So he pointed, Thomas Willis was a hero. I mean, you know, for an African-American in the South, he had a union job making aircraft wings for Lockheed Martin. He went to them and said, there's this white guy, Doug Williams, just harassing us and actually threatening to kill us. And they coddled him, management coddled him and coddled him. And finally, they kept trying to get this guy, this white guy, to go to training, and he wouldn't go. He took a week off from work without letting his employers know. When he came back, they didn't do anything. So tragically, you know, they try to get him to go to one of these ethics classes again. He won't go. He goes to his, you know, goes to his car, gets a shotgun, and intentionally targets the black coworkers he thought had, you know, turned him in or had spoken to management about him. The only white guy who died was a very courageous gentleman who tried to intervene, and, you know, he shot him because he was standing in the way of him killing anything. But so, you know, the Willis family, you know, sues for wrongful death, right? As an intentional act of violence. It goes to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, and they reject it outright. They rule that the shooting, this intentionally racially motivated mass shooting, was a workplace accident.
Now, we have very little time, but I just want to address one other thing. I was wondering how well we're doing at confronting the facts of our history. Edward Baptist's 2014 book, mm-hmm. The Half Has Never Been Told, was criticized in a review in The Economist because, quote, almost all the blacks in the book are victims, almost all the whites villains. The reviewer added that Professor Baptist had abandoned objectivity by putting a few slaves at the heart of his book, which is a book about slavery.
Right, and it's a great book. And I, you know, it just over political correctness, or, you know, I've been criticized for making this film about the, you know, the African American experience or slavery experience in the U.S. And I, my rebuttal is, no, the only person that could have made this film is a daughter of the white privileged South, that we as a nation need to look at this history. We haven't dealt with it because we continue to deny that it exists. And if you really understood the true history, you would not be writing things like that in a criticism of Baptiste's book, which is quite extraordinary, the amount of research that went into it, as well as the amount of research that went into this film, 5 years of my life.
Well, Francis Causey's film, The Long Shadow, is currently at Cinema Village in Manhattan, running until this Thursday. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Francis Causey, to Hugh Sansom, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly here. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.